Ready?
Our evening began in Peter Seychelles' comfortable study in his New York townhouse.
No sleep till
Brooklyn! Yeah.
Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, is that in? From the Battery to the top of Manhattan.
Yo, rope!
Hello there, everybody. My name is Jim Shear, and welcome to the Brouhaha. Joining me today, Jeremy Shatton, music obsessive, blogger, NYC dweller, senior director of development for Hope and Heroes, and the man that took the cover photo for Paul's Boutique. Jeremy, welcome to the Brouhaha.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Glad to be here.
And you were an easy sell. I saw you at MCA Day. I said, hey, would you like to do my Beastie Boys podcast? And you said, sure. And it happened that easily.
Why not?
Because I think our email, our game of email tag took a month or two, but I've been in a game of email tag with Kate Schellenbach for over 2.5 years now. Do you think she'll do it? Because she says she'll do it. And one time she even emailed me out of the blue and she says, I owe you a podcast. And then we just haven't been able to make it happen.
That's an epic phone tag game you're playing. she lives in California.
I know.
Leads a pretty busy life. So probably what I would do is try to catch him next time Luscious Jackson comes around and get her backstage or you know, something like that.
Do you know when they're going to come back? Because they did come back, was it last year or the year before? And I think they only played one NYC show.
GTS, you know what they say. Google that shit.
I've never heard that before, but I think I'm going to use that. Now, did you create that?
Actually, I learned it from Mike D, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, when did he come up with that?
I don't know. I heard him on a podcast or an interview somewhere, and he said GTS, and I was like, God damn it, he's done it again.
Now, I want to start off by talking about your work with Hope and Heroes. Because a lot of times in these interviews, there's a tendency to kind of bury important work like that at the end. But I don't want to skip over it. So let's begin with talking about Hope and Heroes.
So Hope and Heroes is a charity that supports the work that Columbia University Medical Center does with children who have cancer and blood disorders. We raise about $4 million a year.
Wow.
And, you know, we support everything from clinical programs, like things such as survivor wellness or integrative therapies. And we also support research. So it's the full spectrum of activities that they do there for kids. It's a really great program. My son had cancer and died in 1999, so that's how I got into this work, and I really respect what, you know, these kind of people do. So it's a real privilege to work alongside doctors and nurses you know, help them in their work in the one way that I can. I can't give a lot of money, but I can help raise a lot of money.
And you were speaking about your son passing away. So
yeah.
Throughout the years, do you kind of see yourself as someone who can counsel people through difficult times like that?
Yeah, well, I know that when it was really fresh for us, meeting people who were further down the path, the never-ending path of grief and bereavement, you know, was a big help to me, just because in the early days, you don't even know if you can survive.
Mm-hmm.
So just seeing other people and going, oh, you know, there they are. They're 10 years out, or they're 5 years out, or even 2 years out. They're doing okay, you know? So if I can do that for other people, that is very satisfying for me.
Because there's a very well-written post that I read from you online, and just reading the comments, you having the courage to write that, it seems like it gave a ton of people power.
Yeah, I was glad to see that when I wrote that.
So yeah, that's online if you want to check it out. And
yep, New York Times.
What were you doing prior to Hope and Heroes?
This is actually my second nonprofit job. My first was at a place called Children's Brain Tumor Foundation.
Okay.
And that was like my school of nonprofit hard knocks because I had never, you know, done any of that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
That I was a professional photographer for 10 years. I ran my own studio with my wife, and we worked together, and we both, you know, we had our own jobs, our own clients. We both did still life. We had different styles.
Mm-hmm.
And, I did mainly magazine work, but I also did book covers, album covers, that sort of thing. You know, whatever I could get. Catalog, you know, some kind of offbeat catalogs, like for the Keith Haring store, I did one. Skiing magazine was a big client, GQ.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of fun.
Now, did you meet your wife through photography?
I met my wife through my sister, actually.
Oh.
My wife was my sister's first friend at college, and then she brought her back home, and, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
So let's go back to the beginning of your beastie journey, but I guess it was a young Aborigine journey. So I was, when we met at MCA Day, I thought that it was the young Aborigines and that sort of morphed into the Beastie Boys, but you told me that the young Aborigines and the Beastie Boys coexisted at the same time.
They did coexist for a bit, probably for close to a year, I would think. I don't have my diaries available. You know, basically what happened was we were all music fans. You know, Mike and I were huge music fans. And I remember the first time I went into his house, he had a drum set in his room and a practice pad, and I could see this guy was serious. You know, so he was taking lessons, you know what I mean? He wanted to be a drummer. He wanted to know how to play drums.
Right.
So we, you know, we hit it off about music. At that time, I was taking classical and jazz piano lessons very, very badly. I can play the piano only if you give me like 6 weeks to learn the piece, you know, and I have absolutely no improvisational skill at all. There's just something that I didn't connect with, although, you know, I had enough lessons to know that if I'd had it, I would have found it. But, you know, the funny thing is that Mike and I first played in the Walden Jazz Band, which had been quite a storied group when my brother was in it a few years earlier. And I remember they did a concert that lasted over 2 hours playing, you know, jazz classics and stuff that they wrote. And it was unbelievable. You know, we were lucky to squeeze out two songs. Those two songs we did, Watermelon Man by Herbie Hancock.
Okay.
Mercy, Mercy Me, I think it's called, by maybe Joe Zawinul or somebody like that. And I played piano on that, and he played drums. But that was actually the first time that Mike and I played together.
Now, how old were you at this point in time?
Probably 14, 15.
Okay.
So, yeah, I was the MC for the show. It was a musical evening at Walden, and, you know, so it was fun. We spent a lot of time together doing that stuff. But what really happened, you know, to kick things off was John Barry transferred into our school. We were Walden School kids from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had started there in kindergarten, and Mike was a year behind me. So we didn't really become friends till, like, I think he was in seventh grade, I was in eighth grade. And then John Barry transferred from somewhere else. He moved to the city, I think, from Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
Dad, and he came in, and he, you know, I don't know if you ever got to meet John, but he is, you know, he's like a bright person. He just shines.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot take your eyes off him. At least back in those days, he just had that light. And he and I really hit it off for two reasons. First of all, because he freaked everyone else out, and I liked that. And second of all, we both lived above 96th Street. And a lot of people weren't allowed to come up above 96th Street back in those days because it was rough.
Okay.
Hard to believe, you know, million-dollar apartments now in the
yeah.
where I grew up, and you know, burnt-out shells that are now multi-million-dollar apartments just a few blocks from where I grew up. We were on the park, so that was always nice, but I will tell you that, you know, I got my ass handed to me on more than one occasion, either mentally or physically, by other people in the neighborhood. So it could be scary.
Wow.
But, you know, so we both lived above 96th Street, so that definitely set him apart. He lived on 100th and Broadway, and then now legendary.
Yeah.
Home of the Beastie Boys. So, ground zero of Beastie Boyness. But, so, basically, you know, I went over to his house a couple of times, and I said, actually, he had a guitar. He was trying to learn how to play guitar. Mike was trying to learn how to play drums. I thought to myself, you know, let's get these two together, because you can, you know, make music with that combination. Jack White, are you listening? Anyway, so... So my idea to get them to introduce them to each other was to we all go to the same concert. So Joe Jackson's coming to town, and he was the new thing,
mm-hmm.
And the members were opening for him. I remember the night well because I bought a bootleg Clash T-shirt that was way cool on the way into the show. Fortunately, I didn't buy any Joe Jackson merchandise, so there's really no proof that I was ever there. But anyway. He did a great job, actually. But the funny thing was is that we were sitting there, and John is sitting between Mike and I, and the members come on stage, and the members were really energetic. They were, you know, much punkier than Joe Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And John just exploded in his seat. You know, I've told this story before. He exploded in his seat like a crazy man when they started playing. He just, you know, his energy was just phenomenal. And then when their set ended, he went off to the bathroom or to try to get a beer or something like that. I don't know. We were all underage, obviously. But and Mike leaned over to me. He goes, "This guy's crazy." I was like, no. Trust me. He's cool. So it was not looking too auspicious at first. So we, you know, Mike, we didn't know any other guitarists. So eventually, by default, Mike ended up over at John's house. And there was a bunch of drums over there. And they would play together, just the two of them. And I would kind of stand off on the side and make wisecracks or try to play some percussion that I brought over. My parents had, you know, tablas and marimbas and weird shit over the years. So I would bring those over and try to add a little primitive flavor to what they were doing. But the fact of the matter is that I quickly realized that being a bass player would be a good thing.
Right.
I was considering becoming a trombonist because of the Specials and the whole ska revival.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's a really hard instrument.
Yes.
I don't think I would have gotten very far with it. Whereas the bass, I could see, you know, because my hands were big, so, you know, I felt like maybe I could figure it out. So my parents agreed to get me a bass and get me lessons, so... You know, it wasn't too long before the three of us started playing together.
So it's crazy that you had the drummer first, because I've been in bands where you can't find a drummer, and then second, you always need a bass player. I was in a band once where we had three guitarists, and no one wanted to go out and get a bass. So it's nice that you started out with the drummer, and then that you wanted to play bass, so that made it easy for the band.
Every band I've ever been in, there's always been a problem with finding a vocalist.
Really? Wow.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. That's the hardest thing for me. I've been in, well, three or four different bands, and the Young Aborigines were instrumental because we never found a vocalist that somebody who was really going to stick with it. And, you know, we tried, we recorded with vocals, and, but, you know, we never really found anybody great.
On YouTube, there's a short clip of a Young Aborigine song. Is there anything mm-hmm. else in circulation from the Young Aborigines?
There is nothing in circulation. I may be the only one who actually has the music, besides one other person who helped me digitize it a few years ago.
There's more than that one YouTube clip?
Oh, yeah. We pretty much record it all the time. John had a big boombox. Like, he had a really high-quality boombox with a stereo mic. And we record into that.
So how many songs do you have?
How many songs did we have?
No, how many songs do you have? How many songs do you have digitized?
Oh, I've got 3 or 4 CDs worth.
Oh, would you be willing to share one of those?
Well, you know, here's the thing, and I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. You know, in this day and age, you know, I don't know if there's any commercial value to this stuff, but I always felt that unless everybody agreed, do you know what I mean? Because, you know, when you have something like the Beastie Boys, who are such a phenomenal, you know, huge success.
Right.
Something that's a little piece of that, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, what, you know, it's almost like you don't release it at all, or you do it some, in some way. You know what I mean?
So, for
legal tests, I've always just felt like, unless everybody agrees, you know, unless Kate agrees, because she's on this stuff, you know, and Mike would have to agree, you know, I don't know.
So say if there was an under-the-radar, unofficial Beastie Boys podcast that wanted to play one of those songs at the end of this episode, would that be possible?
Yeah, let me think about that.
Okay, so listen till the end, and if Jeremy okays it, you might hear a snippet of a young Aborigines track.
Yeah, I suppose in this day and age, you know, 30 seconds can't get you arrested, right?
No, that would be world exclusive. That would get our listenership up from 200 to maybe 2,000.
That's right.
But like I said,
well,
this is
funny too, because the song that's on the clip that you heard was kind of a one-off song, and that, in many ways, I think was the song that gave the Beastie Boys that kind of had the kernel of the Beastie Boys idea in it.
Uh huh.
Because I always liked the idea in bands when they switched instruments.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
I'm the kind of guy who reads album credits. So, like, when Bowie's Lodger, you know, came out, I was reading the credits, and there was one song where, like, Carlos Alomar is playing the drums, and, you know, Dennis Davis is playing guitar. You know what I mean? It's just, you know, they just switched instruments, and Bowie would do that kind of thing, and Eno, you know, just to get something spontaneous to happen so people weren't always in the same rut. So I suggested when this was late in the Beastie Boys' career, but before, I mean, late in the Young Aborigines' career, but before the Beastie Boys started, I believe. And, you know, this is when we had Kate in the band, and Kate would play percussion, and Mike would play the drum kit, and John would play guitar, and I would play bass. That was the group.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, you know, let's switch instruments. You know, let's play something that you've always wanted to play. So, John, I don't know if that was what the instruction was. Let's just switch.
Mm-hmm.
So, Kate picked up the regular kit. No, that's wrong. Kate picked up the bass.
Okay.
Kate picked up the bass. I picked up the guitar. And John played the drums. And then Mike took the vocal. And that was the first time that he ever sang into a microphone that I know of.
Wow.
And it was a song that I actually wrote the song because I was playing guitar, so, you know, I was kind of leading it.
Uh-huh.
And I really, I had taken guitar lessons for a little time when I was like 10 years old, but I didn't remember any chords, so I was just playing what they call a bar chord, you know, where you just all the strings. And when it's tuned in the conventional tuning, it sounds pretty terrible, but, you know, so I just came up with this riff that went something like down, 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 wah, wah. Pretty easy for Kate to play along to that and for John to get into the groove. And I don't know if Mike came up with it or if I came up with it, but the name of the song is Asshole. Like a parody of a punk song.
Uh-huh.
And basically the chorus just went, you know, asshole with the chords I was playing. And then Mike would, in between the choruses, he would just basically call everybody out, whoever was in the room. Just be like, you know, oh, you know, mostly people in the band, because not a lot of people were there.
Right.
Jeremy, you can't play the fucking bass. You know, you're always screwing up. And John, you know, get that shit out of your hair, you know, because he always had the pomade in his hair. You know, I don't know what he said about Kate. But, you know, that's what the idea was. It was just kind of like a ragging session.
So if it wasn't for your recommendation for everybody to switch instruments, Mike D may have never gotten behind a microphone.
I don't know. I don't know what to tell you.
So when did Adam Yaut come into the picture?
Adam was just one of those people that was around. And he was one of those people that would come back to John's house, and we'd see him at shows. And, you know, I don't really know what happened that made the Beastie Boys happen exactly, but I think, you know, those guys really liked hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
A lot more than I did. I loved the Bad Brains. I thought the Necros were okay. You know, Black Flag had a couple of good songs. But it wasn't really, my thing was just much more eclectic.
Mm-hmm.
I was always like into the sound of the city. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just like, I always loved that feeling of walking down the street and you might hear a Delroy Morgan song. This was the age of the boombox, right? So you hear a Delroy Morgan song coming out of one guy's boombox, and then, like, you know, some hip-hop coming out of somebody else's boombox, and then, you know, it was just, I just kind of liked that, you know, Rick James, and, you know, and then, of course, the Latin musicians who played in the park across from my house. There was a lot of Cuban immigrants there, so they all played drums, like, all night long during the summer, and I just liked all those sounds together, and for me, hardcore was just too reductive.
Mm-hmm.
So
ironically, though, the later Beastie Boys sounds like your dream band.
Well, that's the funny part about it too. Yeah, they did incorporate a lot of that stuff. I mean, that's the story. You know, the funny thing that happened was when Paul Zucchi came out and Mike was playing me the early versions of it when we were making the cover. I was like, Mike, now this is what I'm talking about. You know, that was a band that I could have seen, you know, getting into. I was not interested in the other stuff they were doing. I mean, I thought it was funny, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to play it. And you know, I also felt like, you know, the Bad Brains for me were, you know, that story about, you know, when Eric Clapton saw Jimi Hendrix, he said, well, I might as well go become a bus conductor, you know. The Bad Brains were the Jimi Hendrix of hardcore. You know, they just, there was just nothing better than them. And they played reggae, too, which made them super cool.
Yeah. Because I thought it was neat when you told me the story that the young Aborigines would have practice and then Yauch would come. You guys would swap out and they're like, okay, now it's a Beastie Boys practice.
Exactly. Because, you know, the main thing that would happen was I would get off the bass, John would stay on guitar, and then Mike would take the mic and Kate would switch from the percussion to the kit. So that was the big change that would happen. And, you know, they really had the idea that they wanted to get in on the hardcore scene.
So did the young Aborigines break up, or did you guys just sort of drift apart or not practice as much?
Yeah, it was kind of a drifting thing, I would say. We never said, you know, this is it, I don't think. It was definitely hard for everybody to keep focused on more than one thing at a time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I do remember there was, you know, times where I'd get together with John and we'd be sort of like, what are we going to do to get this thing up and running again? We had the idea of maybe learning some cover songs, you know, that could be a cool thing to do. And, but, you know, there was a bit of momentum behind the Beastie Boys fairly quickly. I mean, one of the things you have to understand is that they would have these hardcore shows all over the city. There was, like, you know, at least five or six different venues where they would have hardcore shows. And there would be five or six bands, and they're all playing for 20 minutes each. So, you know, it's kind of like, it's pretty easy to get in on that. If you have five or six songs and you play like fast, it's kind of like, yeah, we'll put you first. Nobody really cares.
Right.
Nobody's paying you any money. Nobody's really making any money on this deal. It's just fun. But, you know, for a band like the Young Aborigines, who are just kind of out there, there wasn't really a place to slot them in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, years later, maybe.
Yeah. Now, were you at the first Beastie Boys show? Was it Adam Yauch's birthday party at John Barry's?
Yes. I was there.
Wow.
It was kind of funny because we didn't think of it as a show necessarily. It just sort of felt like, you know, here we are at John's house.
Uh-huh.
We had parties there all the time.
Were there friends there, though, that could constitute a crowd?
Yeah, there was probably a few people there.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
all right.
15, 20, I don't know.
So how was that first Beastie Boys show?
Yeah, I'll tell you the truth, I don't really remember it that clearly. you know, for me, we had so many parties at John Barry's house.
Uh-huh.
you know, we had a lot of fun there. His father was often away, so we could pretty much do whatever the hell we wanted.
When I
play music really loud, and you know, so
I remember seeing the Beastie Boys at RFK Stadium for a Tibetan Freedom concert, and they played A Grade on Mojo. And I always thought to myself, I wonder back in the day if they ever, in their wildest fantasies, thought that they would be playing A Grade on Mojo in a sold out stadium.
Absolutely not. I mean, it just, there was no real ambition to it, you know. The funny thing, when we would, you know, we were making this music that was very, you know, like I've said, kind of avant garde and wacky. When we were finished, we would put on Off the Wall or Bob Marley to dance to.
And wow.
Those were like the pinnacle, like Uprising by Bob Marley. Those were like the pinnacle for us of a kind of musical accomplishment in a sense. And the idea, like there wasn't even an idea that you could make music like that. It was just kind of like there. Do you know what I mean? It was
yeah, I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
And I still feel that way about both those records. I think they're fantastic. But, you know, so there always was this kind of divide between what we saw as our niche and the mainstream. And there was never any thought that we would get in the mainstream. Especially, you know, when you're playing the world of hardcore, that was meant to be underground.
Right.
You're not supposed to have a big hardcore band. I mean, even the Bad Brains, as good as they were, they probably never played for, you know, maybe they played on some later kind of victory lap kind of concert.
Right.
Some big audiences, but in their heyday, they probably never played for more than like 2,000 people at once, you know.
Yeah. So I was wondering if you could clear up some Beastie chronology for me. Maybe you can't. When did Adam Horovitz get in the picture? When did John Barry leave the band? And then how did Kate Schellenbach leave the Beastie Boys? Because that's always sort of a gray area in the Beastie history.
What year did Pollywog Stew come out? Do you remember that?
Was Pollywog Stew had to be what? Like, was it 82, 83?
That was, because that was the original band, right?
So Pollywog Stew was John Barry, Kate Schellenbach, Adam Yauch, and Mike D.
Correct.
And then Adam was with the Young and the Useless.
He was with the Young and the Useless.
And they would play shows with the Beastie Boys.
Yep. Pollywog Stew was 82. And then they did Cookie Puss after that. And I think John Barry was still involved with that. So it was pretty shortly after that. You know, they were doing a lot of gigs, and the idea that that you actually needed to show up, you know what I'm saying? It,
right.
It became a little bit professional.
Uh-huh.
So there needed to be, you know, a bit of commitment, and John was in a kind of fucked up stage of his life at that time. So, you know, that's probably around 1983.
Okay.
And, you know, I think it's a little bit like, you know, the Syd Barrett story where it's like, you can't deliver anymore, so you're out of the group. And I think John was, you know, he had his own issues with hardcore. I don't know how committed he was to that long term. He also was not that interested in hip hop. I mean, I'll tell you, you know what John's big passion was besides music was, skateboarding. He was dyed in the wool and that stuff. So we used to have to watch his 8mm skateboard films, you know, that was a little tiresome, but anyway, yeah, I think it was probably slightly after Cookie Puss.
Okay.
So,
and then it seemed like an obvious choice to bring on Horovitz, who played guitar and probably knew most of the Beastie Boys material, I would think.
Yeah.
And then, do you know how Kate was phased out of the group?
Oh, well, one of the funny things about Young and the Useless that I remember is that happened when I was in college. Cookie Puss came out right before I went into college. And then I quickly formed a band in college, and we would rehearse in the city sometimes. We were trying to get gigs and stuff. So I distinctly remember, or maybe it was over the summer in between college, and I distinctly remember the Young and the Useless were rehearsing next door. And they were so bratty. It was unbelievable. You know, we were like these college kids. We were all sophisticated.
Right.
You know? We're just like, God, these kids, they won't stop. So that was the first time I ever laid eyes on Adam Horovitz.
Okay. Now, was he the vocalist of the Young and the Useless, do you know? Or did they have another vocalist?
I don't remember, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
Somewhere I have their first single. I have it in my singles box. But yeah, I guess, you know, just probably playing all those gigs with, you know, 12 bands or whatever, they just hit it off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he had the right attitude, you know, that Mike and Adam were kind of getting into, you know, the sort of, you know, kind of New York Jewish obnoxious kind of, you know, kids, and just kind of being in your face with that. And I think Horovitz was ready to go, you know what I mean, out of the gate with that.
And then everything eventually morphed into the pre-License to Ill era, into the License to Ill era. Kate Schellenbach dropped out of the picture. Do you know if she was like, this isn't my thing anymore, or the Beastie Boys just decided to consolidate into a threesome?
I think it was more, you know, they kind of stopped playing their instruments for a while there. You know, when they hooked up with Rick Rubin.
Okay, that would make sense.
In my new dorm room, and then he hooked them up with DJ Hurricane. Was Hurricane the first DJ?
Dr. Dre.
Yeah, Dr. Dre. When that idea of the three microphones and one DJ kind of thing, you know, it just sort of made Kate, like, kind of obsolete.
Okay.
I think it's safe to say that it was amicable because, you know, we all know what happened, you know, a few years later when Grand Royal put out Luscious Jackson.
Yeah.
Put them on the map. And I always thought that that was something that, you know, any rocker should do, any rock star that reaches a certain prominence, you should always lift up people from your past.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
You should always try to get them, you know, some kind of success.
You should get them to take the cover photo of your sophomore album. So before we get into Paul's Boutique, is the story true that Mike D gave you a copy of License to Ill and you said, no thanks?
That is correct. I to this day do not own a copy of License to Ill.
Wow.
When he moved back to the city after, or kind of came back to roost, after, you know, the tour with Madonna and all that stuff, and I didn't see him for like a year, his house was like filled with, you know, License to Ill merch. And so I remember the moment so distinctly. I don't know why these things stick in your mind, but, you know, he kind of handed me like the License to Ill. It was probably a long box. You remember the long box? He probably sort of, you know, gestured at me with it, like, hey, you know, you want this? And I was just kind of like, not really. And he's like, yeah, I know. You know what I mean? Because I think they had already moved on a little bit from that. But he did give me a knit acrylic hat with the License Still logo on it, which I was like, yes. I still have that somewhere. My wife used to wear it jogging in Prospect Park. It's hilarious.
Oh, that's great.
You know, it's got a big pom-pom on it. It's kind of like a ski hat, like a bad ski hat.
Yeah.
Hey. I thought that. Now, that's merch.
I wouldn't mind having that. So the Paul's Boutique conversation, it happened between you, Mike, and his brother?
That's
you,
right,
you
yeah.
You guys were having lunch or dinner?
Yeah, we were having lunch. I had a studio at that time I was still working for another photographer, and our studio was in Soho. And we often had lunch at Jerry's for special occasions. It's not there anymore, but it was kind of a real hot spot, you know, and the food was really good. So we went there at any opportunity. When Mike and I, you know, got back into contact, we had lunch probably at least once a month. But having lunch with, you know, at that time, Steven was living in Philadelphia, I think. I don't think he was living in the city. So having lunch with Stephen and Michael, that was an awesome, you know, opportunity to hang out with two of my favorite people. So so that was very cool. And that, and the fact that they came to my neighborhood was also nice because, you know, I only got an hour for lunch, basically. So, yeah, we were just having lunch and, you know, having our usual kind of, you know, wide-ranging conversation about everything. And I always like to tell the part how it somehow came up that Mike did not know who Gustav Klimt was. And you have to understand, they grew up with art in their house. You know, they grew up with Brancusis and Mondrians in their house. So Stephen and I were incredulous that he didn't know who, you know, one of the great Viennese painters was. So we were like teasing him about that. And I think maybe to change the subject, kind of squirm out of from that situation, Mike was like, hey, we got this idea for this album cover for our next album, but we don't know how to do it. And I was like, well, what's the idea? You know, is it photographic? You know, or maybe he said it was photographic. And he said, yeah, we want to do a panorama of a New York City intersection. And we want the cover to be panoramic. And I said, yeah, I can help you with that because I knew about these panoramic cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And I had accounts at rental shops, you know what I mean, and accounts at film labs, so I could make all that stuff happen.
So were you fully confident that you could pull this off?
I was 90% confident that I could pull it off, but I did bring in another guy named Matt Cohen.
Okay.
Who was an assistant. The photographer I worked for at the time was a highly technical photographer, very, very accomplished. He did a lot of annual reports, which required him to be able to do portraits, but also to do these large industrial setups. He'd go into like U.S. Steel and take a photo of them pouring like molten steel.
Okay.
And you know, that's a really complicated shot. And I wasn't his assistant. You have to understand, I was not really that interested in the technical aspects of photography. So I was his studio manager. I ran his business, which was, for me, a really great thing to learn how to do. And but I didn't go with him. I never went with him on any shoots. I always stayed in the studio and just, you know, ran the business. So I hired Matt because I felt like we should have one person there who is very seriously technical.
Yeah, because when they make the movie of this, this is the scene where you run home and you're like, oh, shit, I need to call someone. I don't know what I'm doing. I just said yes because it's a big album cover. I don't know.
Well, the other part of it was also I needed someone with an extra set of hands who could, you know, just kind of help me wrangle what we needed to wrangle.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, you know, Matt didn't have a whole lot to do because when you're doing a panoramic shot outdoors, you know, in the middle of a New York City intersection, you don't have a lot of technical control to begin with.
Right.
Basically, you know, you have this camera that spins around, but you can, you know, you put a Polaroid back on it, and the Polaroid, you know, to get your exposure, to check your exposure, the Polaroid only takes one segment. It doesn't take, you can't take a panoramic Polaroid.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally impossible. So you would just take a segment, you know, you do your light reading with your meter, and then you would take a segment and look at the Polaroid and go, yeah, I think we're kind of in the ballpark. And, you know, the thing about it is, when you're shooting a film like that, when you process it, you actually have some leeway. If you kind of make sure not to push it too extremely in the camera, you can actually push it or pull it in the processing. So
okay.
You have some leeway. It's not like life or death if you're, you know, off by a little bit on the exposure. You have a little leeway, but the problem is that you can also lose quality if you do that too extremely in the lab.
And right now, so. Jeremy, there's some kid listening to this podcast, and he's saying, why can't you just do it on your iPhone and hit the panoramic
That's right.
function?
Them's was the days. We didn't have that. So, I mean, this camera wasn't even electronic. It was completely, it was a wind-up toy, essentially, but a very, very good one. So, you know, you wound it up, and it would spin around, and the film inside the back would move the other direction past the lens as it spun around. And that's how you took a shot. I think you got two shots per, I think you got, maybe 2.5 panoramas per roll of film.
Okay. So, now, did you have to sort of hug the tripod and duck down low when the camera was spinning around?
I was under the tripod. I had the cable release in one hand, and I would duck under so that my head wouldn't, you know, be a massive thing and out of a blob, which is what it would be in that situation if I popped up.
Did you end up in any of the prints by chance?
No, not at all. No.
Okay.
I kept my head down the whole time.
Because that would have been a nice, you know, a nice outtake. Like, yeah,
you know, I should have popped up.
Yeah, because Capitol was going deluxe for everything.
Yeah.
So what was one more roll of film?
Yep.
So how did they choose that intersection? Do you know?
You know, I never really asked them, but it just seemed to make kind of sense. It wasn't too far from where they were. You know, they had that place on Christie Street, which wasn't too far from there. And I think, you know, this was obviously a few years later. But I think they had a resonance with that area. And also, you know, it just epitomized gritty New York. And I think that was part of their identity.
Yeah.
And the idea that they could, it was also kind of off the map. You know, we had no permit to shoot there, but it was no problem because there was nobody there.
What time of year did you shoot it? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was April.
April, okay.
I think it was April. It was pretty damn cold. You know, when we got there, because the sun was just coming up.
Mm-hmm.
But I was, you know, the thing that's so great about it is that even though this was for Capitol and this was, you know, going to be a huge production on that end, on our end, it was a scrappy, you know, it was an idea. It was their idea, and it was my job to execute it. So, you know, that's what I did. But I remember being really impressed with the fact that they had, you know, gotten the sign hung. They'd gotten the permission of the guy who owned that store to hang the sign and had the sign made. You know what I mean? This was kind of a little bit more professional than I thought they were going to be. And they had brought all that stuff, you know, the great still life of pop culture detritus that they had in front of the fake Paul boutique.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and I, you know, I also like, you know, there's a little bit of that postmodernism where, you know, we all listen to WLIB, which was Gil Bailey's station, if I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you hear those ads and, you know, there was no way you were ever going to like go to that place that they were talking about.
Right.
So it just became like an idea in your mind, you know,
mm-hmm.
Say, you know, come to Paul's Boutique. You know, I, you know, we had all heard the ad. I used to listen to Gil Bailey falling asleep. That's when I first heard Lee Perry and blew my mind. But, you know, so the idea that this was just sort of it was an idea, and then it's an idea in your mind, something you imagine, and then you make it real and you take a picture of it.
And what did you think when you finally saw the finished product?
I was blown away. I was blown away because, you know, I didn't think Capitol was going to go the whole hog. I mean, they really, not only did they, you know, print it, you know, all eight panels of it, but they used a very heavy stock and gave it a high gloss finish. You know, so that was also a kind of cool, kind of high and low thing going on, was kind of like high production. Even though, you know, there was a lot in the photo that was accidental.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I think there's, you know, there's a lot you can, there's a lot of creativity in that, and sort of the idea of using the means of production to accomplish, you know, to take something that was kind of done out of our back pocket and take it and make it huge. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was very, very cool. That was quite a moment. I really felt like we had accomplished something, you know?
Now, were there any cool stories when you guys were actually shooting? Any passerbys that say, hey, man, what are you doing? Because there's Ad Rock. For years, I could never find him, but he's behind that old guy washing a windshield or getting out of that red car.
Yeah, you know? That's the funny thing about it is I don't remember anybody saying anything to us. You know, it was pretty early in the morning, like I said. There wasn't a lot of street traffic. There's a few people walking around.
Mm-hmm.
guy who's going to open up Economy Candy or whatever down the street. You know, the thing about it was is that when I was taking the pictures, they were like really active and doing all their stuff and kind of performing for the camera. We did work fairly quickly though, because we wanted the early morning light, and also we had a second location that we had to get to.
Whoa. So, now what was the second location?
We had a busy schedule. We had to pack everything up and get everything in the car, and then we went up to 101 Park Avenue,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, on the east side of Park Avenue, just south of Grand Central.
Okay.
And they had another, you know, impressive sign of professionalism. They had actually gotten permission to go up to the roof because they got the idea that, you know, doing a panorama on a rooftop could be cool.
Uh-huh.
So that was also on the, you know, on the docket for the day. So we piled into this car. I don't remember whose car it was, but we were crammed in there. And that's when I first heard Paul's Boutique. They played me, you know, raw stuff. The album had not been sequenced yet. I don't think the final mix had been done. I'm not even sure they had done all their vocals. But they put that on, and I was just like, oh, my God. Because it had all that stuff. It had all the sounds of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And it had all the, you know, the funk and the, you know, the classic rock bits and, you know, just all of the different things that we loved. And they just, you know, larded it on there with the help, obviously, of the Dust Brothers.
Yeah.
We had those collages. I just loved the whole collage aspect of it. You know, you have to understand that I was like the guy who, as soon as the SK-1 came out, that was the first cheap sampling keyboard. I bought an SK-1. You know, I loved the whole idea of sampling culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, tried to make music of my own that way, where I'd take like a Led Zeppelin drum beat and put it with like a Beethoven piano, mm-hmm. you know, or Bach harpsichord, and just kind of try to make this weird thing. And I remember with my sampler, I had, you know, I'd get Little Richard on there, just like a yelp, you know, and I would just be like, ow, mm-hmm. you know, and you could just play that up and down the keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
I love that kind of stuff. So when I heard that, I was like, you know, that was a few years later, or maybe it wasn't, I can't remember exactly, but whenever the SK-1 came out, I got it right away. And so this was like my kind of thing. I really gravitated to that sonic collage. You know, years later, Mike sent me a copy of Introducing by DJ Shadow, and that's, you know.
Yeah.
That's probably the other, well, that's probably one of the top five records made from records. You know, Paul's Boutique is in the top five. That's in the top five.
Mm-hmm.
Donuts by Jay Dilla. You know, those are the kind of records, you know, those kind of things excite me to no end. So.
The picture at Park Avenue, did you guys ever use that for anything?
From what I heard, a shot from that ended up in the Sounds of Science booklet.
Mm, okay.
I don't think I was ever properly credited, I don't have the Sounds of Science, so I can't tell you.
Okay.
I never got that one. So the thing about the rooftop, and the reason it didn't really, it was pretty obviously not going to be the cover, is because one of the things I hadn't bargained for is that on the roof of 101 Park Avenue, there's, like most office buildings, there's a lot of structures. You know, like the you know, New York City, the way buildings get water is you pump it up into a water tank that sits on the top of the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sleek, modern office building like that, the water tank is enclosed in a big, you know, enclosure. So it becomes a big kind of block. And unless you stand on top of that, you're not really going to get the feeling of a panorama of a city. You're going to get, you know, city, 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 structure. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it wasn't that great a situation. I think what they did, I haven't seen it in a long time, but in the booklet, I think the one they used, they just chopped out the part that didn't have any, like, building structures in it. Because that it was, like, too close to the camera. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't shoot a whole lot up there.
You're like, I got the money shot.
Yeah, no, I think we pretty much knew. I mean, we shot probably 30 rolls down on Ludlow and Rivington, and maybe we shot, you know, 10 on the rooftop.
Now, do you have any of those outtake photos in your possession?
No.
No. Did you ever see any of those?
Well, not really, because what I saw, this is how it worked, is it was my lab, so I dropped off the film in my lab, and what you did in those days with film, okay, listen up all you iPhone people, so what you did is you didn't want to run all the film just normal, because what if you were off in your exposure? So what you did was something called a clip test, where literally the lab would, you know, clip off a bit of your roll of film, and they would run that normal.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would look at the clip test, and you would judge it. So a lot of times in a situation like that, where there was so much left up to chance,
mm-hmm.
I think I probably ran 3 clip tests and told them, you know, run one normal, run another pull to half stop, another push to half stop. So that way I could look at the 3 clips and see where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I really didn't want anything to become so inky black that there was no detail in it.
Right.
And nor did I really want anything to become so blown out that there was no detail in it. I wanted detail throughout the shot. Obviously, where that big flare came in, you know, that gets quite blown out. But that was, you know, that was the wonderful happy accident
mm-hmm.
that happened. With the lighting that nobody predicted until we saw the film. So I never actually even saw the whole film because I pulled I ran the clips. I told them what to do. I don't remember exactly how I ran the film, but I told them what to do after looking at the clips. And then I just told Mike, you know, send your messenger.
So now do they exist?
I have no idea. I don't know how much of a pack rat you know, the boys are, but I, you know, if you look at the cover of Paul's Boutique with all that junk,
yeah, but
I would imagine that there's somewhere in a box, some, you know, I would hope. I mean, it wouldn't take up too much room.
Yeah. So do you think the Beastie Boys would have it, or would Capitol Records have it?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know.
We should have like a reality show where me and you hunt down the outtakes
right.
from Paul's Boutique.
We're going to the Capitol Tower, people. And we're landing in a helicopter.
Did you see Fight for Your Right Revisited?
Oh, yeah, I did watch that.
What did you think of Lose, Adam Yauch's daughter, sort of recreating his pose in Paul's Boutique? And she's wearing the same flannel, too.
You know, I don't remember that detail, to tell you the truth. I just remember laughing a lot.
But I
don't remember that part. I should watch it again.
Yeah, so watch it tonight. But I always thought it was such a clever nod to Paul's Boutique because she is wearing the same exact wardrobe as Yauch. And then I think she ends up running into Yauch, who's played by Danny McBride.
That's right.
My next question, did you have, following Paul's Boutique, what was your relationship like with the Beastie Boys?
My relationship with Beastie Boys, well, Mike and I, you know, that was the main relationship that mm-hmm. I had with those three guys. Adam, Yauch, and I were always friendly, you know, always got along. I always thought the world of him. But my deep relationship was with Mike because we had known each other a long time, and you just have to understand how much time we spent together. Because when we were in high school, I walked right by his house on the way home. So I would say, you know, 6 times out of 10, he would say, "You want to come up?" And I would go up, and I would have dinner there, and we played music together. So when he was making Paul's Boutique, and after that, we spent a lot of time on the phone. I was one of his kind of resources for finding records, mm-hmm. you know? So he would call me up and be like, "I just can't find this Lee Dorsey Great Googa Mooga, you know, double CD on Charlie Records." And I'd be like, "Well, you know, I have to go up to Tower for something else, so I'm walking by there, so I'll go in there." And it was a great deal for me because he would pay me back and I would get to tape the record. So, you know, that was a good deal. So I did that for him quite a bit. He also would send me a lot of records and mixtapes.
Yeah, this brings up a topic I wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
It's written about in Dan Leroy's book, For Whom the Cowbell
right,
Tolls.
Yeah.
Mike D had horrible mixtape etiquette.
Mm.
His sins were atrocious.
No,
he would play back-to-back songs from the same artist?
Mixtape. He was a mixtape artist. Oh. See, that's the difference. See, I was a mixtape perfectionist. I would never include two songs by the same artist on the same side of the tape. I would never let any song get cut off.
Yes.
I liked there to be a flow to
yes.
it.
Yes.
You know, where it would start out slow and then it would build up and then you flip the tape and it would slowly, you know, ease its way down.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of, you know, 1 minute songs so I could fill things up right to the white.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yeah. But that's the way I learned how to make tapes and I think I was pretty good at it actually. So, but Mike's whole thing was fuck all that. It's about the music. And it's just about that moment of the music. And you know, it's kind of like a breakbeat, almost a breakbeat conception where it's almost like the song doesn't really matter. It's just what's the sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So, and it's also kind of, I think there's a, you know, if you want to get kind of theoretical about it, I think there's a kind of arrogance to it, which is part of Mike's personality. And I don't mean that as a criticism. I just mean, you know, he's a very, very, you know, he can seem very shy and kind of retiring in a way. Like, you know, he talks very quietly a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
but there's a kind of swagger, and that's the way he did it. My whole thing was like, I am showcasing these fantastic songs that I've put together for your enjoyment. And you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, the other time I ever heard anything like that was Paul Westerberg. Did you ever hear his 49 Minutes, I think it's called?
No.
49 Minutes. It was a 49-minute collage that he sold on Amazon only for 49 cents. It's fucking brilliant. And, you know, nobody really understands how much of a genius Paul Westerberg is. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that, like, five people downloaded. I mean, it's just fantastic. And it's kind of like that on those mixtapes that Mike would send me where, you know, one song just runs into another and there's no care for convention of that kind of stuff. So I really love them.
Okay.
Because,
wow.
Because look, if I want a perfect mixtape, I can make it. You know what I'm saying? But I couldn't do what he did. Because also what he was doing was he had a dual well deck and he would run off a copy for me, but he wouldn't care if the tapes were slightly off sync. So that's how come, you know, the song would get cut off, and then the thing with auto flip. Like if I'm dubbing a deck, if I'm dubbing a tape, I would never use the auto flip because you can't be sure that the time is going to be just right.
Yes,
I would run it to the end and then physically flip the tape around.
Yeah, I'm with you, Jeremy. You know, I'm with you.
I understand, but his whole thing was just like, let's just get this done. And you know, I'm going to the post office today. I don't have time to like flip the thing, or I'm going to take a shower while this thing dubs, and it's going to flip by itself, and it's going to be what it's going to be. And, you know, they were awesome. You know, the only tape of his that I didn't really love was the one that he made in Tower Records where they had this machine. Do you remember this thing?
I don't.
Yeah, they had a machine at Tower Records where you would scroll through a menu of songs and then they would dub it onto a cassette for you.
No.
And it was like, the problem with that is that there was none of that, you know, groovy, weird, you know, shit that he would do.
Right.
It was very, very clean, but it also, it wasn't, it was just kind of like a list of songs. It didn't have
right.
You know, there were some great songs on it. But, you know, he sent me all that stuff. And we would talk on the phone literally sometimes for over an hour. And it was 99% of the time it was about music. That was our strongest connection.
So, if you guys were to go out to a concert, what concert would you go to if you could take your pick today in 2015 that you would both thoroughly enjoy?
What's that? I'd like to see, you know, I'm not 100% sure I know his taste anymore, but, you know, Kendrick Lamar is somebody I'd really like to see live. I think that'd be fun to go with him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not 100% sure what he's into, but, you know, I like a lot of stuff I love Kendrick, I love Kanye, but I also love, like, His Golden Messenger and The Clientele and, you know, kind of quieter stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what he thinks of that. But you know who he might like? There's a fantastic band in California called TV Girl.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard of them. They are just, I saw them live a couple months ago, and they are just so much fun. I think Mike might get into them. They have a bit of the sampling culture thing going on. They have a bit of like the Saint Etienne, you know, 60s pop thing going on. Lyrics are very clever. Especially in concert, the beats are massive.
Ooh.
Like block rocking hip hop beats.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good.
And then they have this kind of like sampledelic, like 60s, you know, TV commercial sound over them. And I like TV Girl a lot. I think Mike would like it too.
And just one final question on the mixtape subject. Would you guys make artwork for your mixtapes?
No. I mean, I would sometimes, but usually I just wanted to make sure everybody knew exactly what songs were on the tape.
Mm-hmm.
When I got my first computer, or Ooh. When I got Macintosh, and I started teaching myself Quark, which was an early form of design software. Now I use InDesign like everybody else, but I used to make beautiful cassette covers using my graphic design skills. You know, I was kind of teaching myself how to do it, and that was like my playground.
Uh-huh.
So because I when I was still being a photographer, it was helpful to be able to design my own promo cards and, you know, stuff like that. So I taught myself how to use design software. And, you know, one of these days I'll dig out some of those covers and shoot them, put them on Facebook, because some of them I was really proud of. I thought they were very good. Like, I did one for an Otekra mix, uh-huh. another electronic band, and I, like, totally fucked up the type, like, so badly. I imported the type into Photoshop, and I converted it to a line, and then I, you know, dragged it through all these filters, because I just wanted it to, like, represent the music. So, yeah, I used to do that, but in those days, and, you know, Mike, like, I have bad handwriting. Mike has horrendous handwriting. So, you know, half the time you couldn't even read what was on there. And sometimes he wouldn't, mixtape etiquette, he wouldn't even give you the names of the songs.
Wow.
Yeah, like the first one he sent me, all it said on it was, Pimpin' and Mellow, Happy Birthday, Jeremy. That's 1990. That's all it said on it.
Now, when was the last mixtape that you made?
There were actually songs on the first on that tape that I didn't know what they were called until I could Shazam them.
Wow!
I was like, "What is that song? Oh, it's Benny King, right?"
But in the playlist era, do you still make mixtapes?
No, I don't make cassettes anymore. I usually make Spotify playlists.
Spotify, okay.
I do a lot of stuff on Spotify. And I haven't burned a CD in a while because the last time I upgraded my OS, it stopped burning CDs. You know what I think is really the rotten part about the streaming revolution related to playlists? Is like, I'll see, like, my friend has published a playlist, you know, it's called like, you know, Funky Favorites. I'll be like, oh, this would be cool. I'm sure this, you know, and the thing is fucking 4.5 hours long. I'm like, excuse me, I'm not going to be your pawn for 4.5 hours. I'm going to be your pawn for, you know, 60 minutes or 90 minutes, and right. That's it. So, like, you'll almost never, unless I'm making a playlist just for me, or like when Lou Reed died, I made a playlist that's like 2.5 hours. But mm-hmm. fuck it, Lou Reed, you
right.
know what I mean?
Right.
And, you know, and you really should listen to the end because there's some really interesting stuff in there that I found on Spotify. But, I think mixtapes be a certain length, and, you know, they should have a certain, you know, life to them outside of just a list of songs. So it's definitely different, but I like the Spotify interface in general and do stuff on there.
So when the Beastie Boys were putting out Hello Nasty, To the Five Boroughs, would you ever catch them in concert?
Yeah, the last time I saw them at Lollapalooza, I think that was 1994.
Or did you, in Chicago?
No.
Oh, the tour. Okay, yeah, that was 94.
I saw them in Randall's Island. Yeah, my sister and I went. We had a fantastic time. We saw the Flaming Lips for the first time on the second stage. It was pretty awesome. They were great. And then, you know, the funny thing is, I saw them at Madison Square Garden somewhere along the way. I sat with Mike's brother, David. That was also a lot of fun. And the last time I saw them, I think, was in 99, when my son It was either 98 or 99 I saw them at Continental Airlines Arena,
mm-hmm.
whatever they call it now, the IZOD.
Okay.
And Mike, you know, knew that I was going through. It was either when my son was sick or after he had died. And Mike, I think it was actually when he was still sick. And Mike was just like, you want a night out, you know, come to the show. So my sister and I went out there. And that was actually the last time I saw Adam Yap.
Wow.
I think that was like 1998. Yeah, so I went backstage and met Biz Markie. So it was, you know, done deal. That was a great night. You know, I got to shake Biz Markie's hand and see him. He won the backstage basketball game with one of the ugliest shots I've ever seen. So ugly, but it went right in. You know, it just, it looked terrible. And then I got, you know, his hand is like as big as both my hands put together. just the man. But the Beastie Boys, that was, you know, they were kind of at a peak. Because
oh,
they
yeah.
Could do, they had, you know, for one thing, they had keyboard Money Mark,
mm-hmm.
who's, you know, I think really brilliant.
Yes.
Everybody should download him, you know, Mark's Repair Shop. And they also had Mix Max or Mike. So they had
yeah.
they had a couple, and they had the percussionist. So they had some virtuosos,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean, fill out their sound. And also the fact is that, you know, they all became really good. You know, Yauch, he's playing the upright bass. He's doing all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really the pinnacle show for me where it all came together. And they did, you know, they did stuff with turntable. They did stuff with instruments. And they did instrumentals. And that was like a lot of fun.
You said to yourself, man, if you were doing this in 81, I'd be in the band right now.
Well, yeah, but has there ever been a good rock band with two bass players?
Now, do you know if their book's ever going to come out?
I read somewhere recently that it's coming out in 2017.
Okay. Yeah. I was hoping 2016, but I wasn't holding my breath. So we think 2017.
That's what the internet told me the other day.
Okay, and
I happen to be cruising by somewhere.
Do you think they'll ever release any of their unreleased material?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, I remember telling Mike, you know, several years before they did the deluxe editions of all their albums that they should do that. I'm like, everybody else is doing it. You know, you guys, I'm sure you have some good outtakes. And he was just like, you know, nostalgia is not for me, you know.
Wow.
And I think there's still a part of him that's like that, you know, where he doesn't want to look back.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, they were like three peas in a pod. I mean, they were,
yeah,
to go through all that, to make all the decisions without MCA, I think that would be really, really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I will respect them either way.
Yep.
They've obviously stood up for MCA's wishes with, the, you know, any commercial usage of the music.
Mm-hmm.
They've come down that hard and fast, and as they should. But, you know, I just think that, you know, if there's really great stuff, you know, the other part of it is I'm on the other side because, like, you know, like I wrote about in my blog, I'm kind of betwixt and between because I know the guys, but I also know all you guys, all the guys, you know, in the Beastie family group on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
who are just, you know, their lives are really lifted up by these guys,
and yeah,
by their music,
yep.
And to have more of it would just be, you know, a dream come true for thousands and thousands of people all around the world.
Yeah,
that's an amazing thing. They really touched people all around the world. It was not just a New York thing. I mean, everywhere from, you know, Japan to Turkey to, you know, probably somewhere, you know, in the Russian steppes, you know, there's probably somebody listening to the Beastie Boys, to Africa, you know, to Jamaica. I mean, it's just all over the world. And they created a whole culture, you know, a whole hipster kind of vinyl maniac, you know, crate digging kind of culture that I think a lot of people still really aspire to. So, you know, to have more of it would be obviously great, but I 100% respect them for, you know, they're never going to do what anybody tells them to do.
That's yeah.
Boys ethos.
Although if you, next time you see Mike D, if you tell him what you just said, that might sell him. That was beautifully put.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, there was nobody more surprised at the success of the Beastie Boys than my mother. Because Mike would come over to my house, he wouldn't look her in the eye, and he would, you know, walk down the hall to my room with hopefully not saying anything to anybody else but me. I had three, you know what I'm saying? And so I said, yeah, I'm going to see the Beastie Boys, you know, at some club somewhere, you know. And she goes, what? You know, Mike, what is he doing? I said, he's on stage. He's a wild man on stage. And she was just like, Michael? That the guy who won't look me in the eye and won't shake my hand or, you know, say anything to me?
Oh, my gosh.
I said, well, you know, he's got a different perspective. You want to know something funny? She liked License Still better than I did. Because she would hear Fight for Your Right in the après ski bar when she was having a beer after skiing all day. And she thought it sounded pretty damn good. So, you know, that was the music that Mom was supposed to hate, and right. She liked it better than I did.
Oh, man. Well, Jeremy, I can't thank you enough for doing this tonight.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it immensely, and I hope to see you at MCA Day next year.
I hope to get there, you know?
Yeah, because I know you were trying to get there for a couple years, yeah. And it only happened this year, but it was great having you in attendance, and I know that there were a lot of Beastie geeks geeking out because you were there, including myself. And I just want to point out really quick that you can follow Jeremy on Instagram at, is it Murgatroyd? Or
Murgatroyd, at Murgatroyd on Instagram.
And are you posting a picture a day?
I do a picture a day, yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I like that you're still in the game.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. My iPhone put me back in the photo game big time. I love it. So, and my Twitter is An Earful.
An Earful. And you also do the blog An Earful.
Yes, anearful.blogspot.com, and also on facebook.com/anearful.
For Jeremy Shatton, my name is Jim Shear, and we will see yins later.
Yo, we gonna end it on a 1-2-3 note. Are you ready? 1-2-1-2-3.
Guarantee we bring the brouhaha.
It's a brouhaha.